طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. We begin this week with the campaign by various vestiges of the Israeli lobby to silence pro-Palestinian voices on the U.S. campus. Recently, the Electronic Intifada made available on their website links to the long-suppressed Al Jazeera video that exposes the magnitude of the organized, well-financed pushback against the Palestinian narrative by a variety of Zionist organizations, some underground, on our college campuses. I want to focus this story by reading a Mondo Weiss article written by Nada Elia, a Palestinian scholar, activist, writer, grassroots organizer, currently completing a book on the Palestinian diaspora. Nada reports on the current campus controversy. She writes, "Last week I was asked to speak in a classroom alongside someone from the Jewish group Stand With Us. Apparently the professor was going by a recommendation to have me as a discussant to possibly provide the, quote, other side. Without getting into a discussion of what those two sides are, pro-apartheid and pro-justice, of course, or why I will not be party to normalizing, setting up the illusion that both sides are equal, rather than oppressor and oppressed, occupier and occupied. I sent this response, which I tried to keep short and to the point. Thank you for the request, which I must decline. I must also say that I find it quite worrisome that you would have representatives of this group talk to our students. Stand With Us is a right-wing propaganda organization which actively stifles free speech and critical thinking by equating any and all criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. This is extremely intimidating for students attempting to formulate their own thoughts about the topic and distracts from the real anti-Semitism that targets all Jews, regardless of their political ideology. Jewish Voice for Peace mentions Stand With Us among the more aggressive organizations stifling dissent on campuses and in various political circles in their extremely valuable report. I trust you agree with me that we are living in troubling times. The current national climate, indeed the global climate in which the Trump and Netanyahu administrations are working hard and hand in hand, should impress us with a need to critically disentangle anti-Semitism from anti-Zionism, the latter being criticism of and oppositions to a political worldview, albeit one held by many Jews. Of course, you must also be aware of the fact that, numerically speaking, there are millions more Christian Zionists than Jewish Zionists. The distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is one that activists for Palestinian rights have long been arguing, yet one that keeps getting blurred by organizations such as Stand With Us. which persists in their claim that criticism of Israel's policies is a thinly disguised form of Jew hatred. I hope you can present the students with the appropriate context for having representatives of this group talk to them in your class. Best, Nada. Nada continues her article. As I consider this request, which coincided with the National Students for Justice in Palestine, NSJP, annual conference, which both the City of Los Angeles and the host school, the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, tried to ban, and in light of the numerous violations of the academic freedom of anti-Zionist faculty and students across the country, I couldn't help but marvel at how some administrators bend over backwards to accommodate any representatives and requests from Zionist organizations, while also bending over backwards to censor and criminalize any representative and requests from the pro-Palestinian rights organizations. UCLA even sought a cease and desist against NSJP for using a bear in their poster, for fear the image would be viewed as the school's mascot and thus interpreted as official endorsement of the conference. In their cease and desist letter, NSJP, UCLA administrators also demanded that the poster advertising the conference not show the bear flying kites, as this would be viewed as an incitement to violence. As NSJP wrote in their statement, UCLA's action demonstrates how out of touch they are with the facts and how quickly they are willing to associate the Palestinian rights movement with harmful, broad-sweeping stereotypes and caricatures. That knee-jerk response from such university administrators is similar to that of law enforcement officers who can somehow take mass killers alive if they are white. Think Dylan Roof, who was offered a burger and fries when he complained he was hungry, and more recently, Tree of Life Synagogue mass killer Robert Bowers, even though he had actually shot at three cops, but kill African-American children in their sleep, on the playground, and outside their homes, or shoot adult African-Americans for, let's see, driving, crossing the street, entering their apartment? And over again, we find out that these African-Americans are innocent, unarmed, legally armed, and not misusing their guns. The last murder by a law enforcement officer of an African-American male that made national headlines was the killing of a security guard who was doing his job, holding down a killer and protecting the patrons. The whites who were taken alive, as indeed everyone should be, were mass murderers. Maybe if we present the situation in that way, some university administrators will get it. Maybe we can start a campaign responding to every university attempt at censorship with, "Stop, think, you are being a racist cop." Would that give them pause? Would they consider their knee-jerk censor them first, fire them if they will not be silenced? Seriously, if administrators now consider a cuddly bear flying a kite, albeit with a Palestinian flag, as a possible endorsement of incitement to violence, how are they different from the most viciously racist cops? This is happening as Jewish students and faculty on many campuses are also expressing their frustration with administrators and staffs cracking down on criticism of Israel from within the Jewish community while providing a platform for Israeli propagandists. Jewish Voice for Peace's report, Stifling Dissent, provides solid analysis of the divide within the Jewish American community over Palestine advocacy. At Northeastern University, for example, Hillel alienated and excommunicated students who established relationships with members of Students for Justice in Palestine, pushing both students and faculty to the margins or even off campus, while inviting Israeli activist Itamar Marcus to speak on campus and using that speech as a fundraiser for Hillel. Marcus is former president of the Central Fund of Israel, an organization highlighted in the New York Times article for using its tax exemption to fund settlement projects in the West Bank. Marcus himself lives in the Efrat settlement. The struggle to speak truth to power, the permission to narrate, as Edward Said put it, has been going on for decades, but has recently shifted from isolated individual cases to a national issue thanks to the visibility of faculty who openly challenge their censorship and unfair treatment, and the support of a few legal and civil rights organizations, i.e., Palestine Legal and the ACLU, have done much needed work to stem the assault on Palestine advocacy. It's time to elevate it one step further. Let's ask our administrators to stop and think before you censor, or be academia's racist cops. That was a Mondo Weiss report written by Nada Elia. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is an exploration of the Christian Evangelical Zionist movement, which is huge in the United States. The presentation is by Thomas Gedman before a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. It begins with his introduction.
Our next speaker is discussing the topic of Christian Zionism. For those of you who don't know, Christian Zionism is the belief that the establishment of the modern state of Israel in the Holy Land is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy and thus deserves unrelenting support from Christians. When President Trump announced in December his intention to declare Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, many attributed his decision to the power of Christian Zionists, who are a key Trump constituency and have a powerful and devoted member in Vice President Mike Pence. But just how powerful the Christian Zionists are is up for debate, and we will address that today. There are also theological questions about Christian Zionism and the extent to which it is legitimate interpretation of Scripture and to the extent to which it is heretical. I like that word. And finally, questions as to how it started, where is it going, and who is challenging the evangelical community. To discuss this today, we have Thomas Gedman. He is a partner in a private consulting group that specializes in international, United Nations, and non-governmental organization affairs. He got his start in South Africa and fighting for justice there, and later discovered the Palestine issue. He has worked primarily, as many of you know, for World Vision, where he worked continuously for Palestinian issues in the West Bank and Gaza. I believe, yes. And with that, I will like to introduce him to discuss Christian Zionism.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks to the wonderful organization of our sponsoring groups and for your being here to discuss these important issues with us. As the resident theologian today, I must tell you that particularly this morning, I was reminded that we operate within a very secular climate, but we also operate in an aura of the creation ordinances. And sometimes that's forgotten. And I cut my eye teeth on human rights in the Middle East because the likes of Tutu and Boussac and Beresnaudeh and people like that said to me, if I really wanted to prove my bona fides in terms of human rights, I should turn my eyes to the Palestinians. And I really am grateful for that, because I was, truth be told, a complicit evangelical Zionist like the polling data today showed, but unwittingly. I didn't even know what it meant. But living and working in the Middle East for 5 years to begin with, and now 20 years all told, we see that there is a breaking forth of history that is beyond our usual comprehension of things. It's good to be reminded, as we seek reasons for hope, that those who lay traps get their own feet ensnared. Those that do things in the dark haven't come into the light. And there are things happening on college campuses today, university campuses today, because of the suffering of our sister from San Francisco State. What man means for evil, the transcendent order understands for good. So the topic today drives us to seek to understand the question today is helpful to comprehend that American Christians, in particular, speak in two theological languages when it comes to Israel and Zionism. We are living in a troubling culture with a culture war darkness as a nation, and this may help us understand how we arrived here. The great majority of mainstream Christians, that would be Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, and even more than 20% now of the 100 million evangelicals are rooted in a 2,000-year orthodoxy that was quantified during the creedal debates of the 3rd century. It's not just religion we're talking about. It's not just creedal material we're talking about. We're talking about social justice. On the other hand, Zionism, both Jewish and Christian, is rooted theologically in a 19th and early 20th century minority belief, and in it, the Bible predicts 7 dispensations of history. A real stretch to do this kind of cherry picking. Moving us toward the return of all Jews to Palestine, or more appropriately, Jews to all of Palestine, in order to hasten the day of the end times. You may have noticed recently there have been some predictions about when it was coming. I hope you got your stuff stored away. It's been popularized by the Left Behind fictional series. This view purports Christians suddenly disappear, presumably to heaven. A final apocalyptic war, Armageddon, occurs against the evil Antichrist, and a 1,000-year peaceful reign of the Messiah begins. Everyone is judged as to their faithfulness to God's plan, but ironically, 2/3 of all Jews are killed and the rest become Christians. The millennial reign, according to Zionists, began with 1948 and 1967. Zionism becomes dangerous when it aligns with empire and ethnic religious nationalism. Ethical guidance takes a back seat, especially with exceptionalism. This highly imaginative view is considered heresy in most of the theological circles. And it's no longer widely embraced by evangelicals, certainly not by rabbinic Jews or by main denomination Christians, unless it's without thought, without really knowing the issues. That's where our responsibility comes in. Even Billy Graham said he was agnostic about the end times when he declared it will all pan out in the end. But silence in the mainstream church has allowed Palestine to be defined by Zionists. It is the basis of Christian Zionism, about which a straightforward definition is offered by Dr. Don Wagner, a Presbyterian, former Zionist himself, when he states, "It is a movement within Protestant, now Catholic fundamentalism that understands the modern state of Israel as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy and thus deserving of political, financial, and religious support." Christian Zionism proceeded by 50 years and even influenced the emergence of Jewish Zionism. Surprise? When the British literalists cherry-picked biblical references to apply to a physical state for diaspora Jews, ultimately they helped to bring about what their adherents promoted and now believe is that state brought through an act of God in 1948. This nationalistic perspective can be seen as a key to understanding the troubling geopolitical field fire fanned by the Jerusalem announcement by the U.S. president and the fawning, fumbling visit by the vice president. It explains the division of the house in Israel, which resulted in damaging replacement of rabbinic social justice Judaism with secular Jewish Zionism. Recent history shows the resulting marriage of convenience for joint image protection by the Jewish Christian lobby. So how did we arrive here? Especially at this crucial juncture, it's important to understand it. The 200-year progression of this history is at once instructive and frightening. We can see the consequences of rationalizing colonialization and partisan politics, influenced by religion, to exclude the rights of one group over another. The law of love is replaced by violence. South Africa, former director of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Georgetown professor Charles Villavicencio, explained, "It's the fault line running through Western civilization. The first century of the Common Era, the church was born, and the synagogue was transformed. In the midst of this issue, religions separating groups with the right of one group to dominate the other, or whether they bring humankind to the realization of our unity and connectedness. As children of the Father Abraham and recipients of his promise to establish many nations." This is the central issue. The lobby writ large is the questionable combining of forces between the Israel government and American Christian Zionists. Our government and our church people are complicit in this furtive enterprise, sometimes unwittingly. AIPAC is successful as an agent of minority Gentile sentiment, not just Jewish support. And sadly, the majority, as you heard from me early, has been silent. We must stir them up. And I propose it is bad for Israel as well as America's place in the free world. It's destined for failure. It is important to see the progression of Christian Zionism's development. It has roots at least as far back as the 16th century European Reformations, the early literal readership of the local language translations like the King James Bible, later in Schofield reference editions, had footnotes and commentary that promoted dispensational Zionism. It led to several centuries of anti-Semite Jewish persecution, ultimately the Holocaust, and all the way to the mid-20th century best-selling fictional works of the late great Planet Earth and Left Behind. The modern movement can be traced to early 19th century with a group of eccentric British Christian restorationists lacking formal theological training. They began to lobby for Jewish return to Palestine and the necessary precondition for the second coming of Christ, or the first coming of the Messiah, as you wish. John Darby was their leader, and the Darbyists gained traction from the middle of the 19th century when Palestine became strategic to Britain, France, and Germany in their colonial interests in the Middle East. These Christian Zionists who preceded Jewish Zionism were some of Theodor Herzl's strongest advocates. And ironically, were both clergy and lay people who embraced the anti-Semitic theology and genocidal images around racial nationalism. Herzl's appeal to the British leadership was in part on an understanding anger for what had happened to Jews in the previous centuries, but also undergirded by misinterpreted scriptures. In the early 20th century, evangelist Billy Sunday, D.L. Moody, and others promulgated the Schofield Bible dispensational point of view to convert people by employed end-of-the-world fear. As early as 1917, the British bartered away Palestine with the Balfour Declaration, and the 1919 American King Crane Report urged caution about Zionist intention of dispossession, but the report's attention to the local population was either ignored or buried by President Wilson for several years. This was concurrent with the Arab false appreciation that they would gain Palestinian liberation by their alliance with the Ottomans. Arthur Balfour and Lloyd George were predisposed towards Zionism and their support for a Jewish national home, but with mixed racist motives about white British superiority. Their primary goal was to advance British imperial interests with utilitarian politics. Zionism continued to reflect some of that strain into the middle of the last century and to today. After World War II, more urbane Billy Graham avoided the label Zionist with his approach, which stirred millions. He did not, however, instruct about the dangers of Zionism in the churches to which he sent his converts. Even with his anti-Semitic misstep recorded with Richard Nixon, fortunately, he founded Christianity Today magazine, a globally minded, modern, evangelical publication that reflected his social justice abolitionist roots and has had a series of progressive editors partnering with Anglican scholar, anti-Zionist John Stott, and the NGO-sponsored trips to the Holy Land. Sadly, his son Franklin hasn't taken the same path. The impact of the Holocaust in this era was a legitimate concern, and then coupled with the guilt about U.S. capping Jewish asylum and turning away refugees, the UN partition resolution of November of 1947 was supported by Harry Truman. He was influenced certainly by his dispensational beliefs, but likely even more by the looming re-election campaign considerations and the financial infusion from pro-Israeli donors. The fact was ignored that Palestinians, as the 66% majority, owned 90% of the land. Christian Zionism was encouraged when in 48 Israel was assumed to be the sign of God and his personal intervention, with the anticipation of the end time battles of Armageddon, and was as well influenced by APAC's predecessor, American Zionist Council. It gained impetus after the return of Jews to what they called the eternal undivided capital in 67. Which encouraged the populist teaching of dispensational theology by Dallas Seminary and similar seminaries, especially throughout the South in the Bible Belt. The more secular Israeli Labor Party had few relationships with Christian Zionists prior to the election of Likud's Menachem Begin in 1977. Begin, however, saw the necessity of the theopolitical match made in heaven. Likud courted the relationship with leaders such as Falwell, Robertson, and other TV preachers who captured the TV time for most Christians, and from the booming fundamentalist Zionist churches in the South. In 1979, with great fanfare, Falwell was presented a private jet by Begin, purportedly to affirm the Israeli policies such as their soon 1981 bombing of Iraq's nuclear site, but also to spread the Zionist action plan. The election of Ronald Reagan, who was converted to Christian Zionist beliefs, helped solidify Christian Zionism at the center of the Republican Party in the White House, along with several speakers of the House. Opposition began to be more public by well-known liberal ministers and scholars, and even John McCain called Falwell and Robertson agents of intolerance. Still, Jewish Zionists had few encounters with Christian Zionists before 2000, even with the assumption by Christians that the 67 war miracle was final proof to them for the return of Jesus. It took politics of necessity to drive the strange bedfellows together, helped, of course, by Jewish lack of faith in the Zionist Christian distasteful end-time creed. 9/11 sealed the marriage. The glue was that they both feared and hated Muslims. This hastened the growth of the so-called evangelical Zionism. In this present era, and especially with the election of Trump and the Republican Congress, an encouragement movement in opposition to Christian Zionism has grown among mainstream political and religious entities. This has helped us to battle complicity. Those who lay the traps will have their own feet caught. As the Zionist profile became more public through the pro-Israel lobby of Christians and Jews, especially through John Haggai's Kofi, Christians United for Israel, three factors were apparent. First, the lobby served to undermine peace and increase, even encourage violence. Second, their utterly biased and one-sided utterings and massive funding have been opposed by Jews as well as Christians. And finally, third, the United States is seen increasingly to be a party to injustice rather than an honest broker for a just settlement of the conflict. The lobby's goal to stand shoulder to shoulder for significant influence in Washington by portraying Israel in a positive light in public discourse is proving more difficult and counterproductive. The Israeli lobby is being seen as an agent of the foreign power, in part because of Mr. Netanyahu's debt demands and decline, thank God, and Mr. Trump's ignorance and intrusion. More open debate is happening on university campuses, as we've just heard, especially as BDS has caused panic efforts in Congress and Knesset to limit First Amendment freedoms. And print and broadcast media, pro-Israeli editorial, and news bias shows real signs of change. Greater understanding is occurring about faulty oppressive theology and excesses and American Christian complicity in illegal neocolonial activity. There is an increasing awareness of severe demonization of Palestinians, Muslims, and Christians. Treatment of other minorities within Israel and the region is stirring opposition, especially because of the horrors of Gaza, the expulsion of African refugees, and the church tax bank issues. Many more people, including the young, are traveling with alternative social justice agencies to the traditional Holy Land holy sites, but they're spending a lot more time than has been traditionally the way in the West Bank, talking to the Livingstones who are demanding liberation. The arc of history is being bent toward justice by young people. Polling and experience indicates that evangelicals, especially millennials, are more pro-immigrant, less Islamophobic, and increasingly concerned about the negative impact of occupation and annexation. Appreciation is growing for and in solidarity with influential progressive and modern Zionists, for instance, Plus 972, Laura Friedman, Rabbis for Human Rights, and mainstream Israeli combatants for human rights as they seek help on their PTSD. Pilgrims, even now, amazingly, some enlightened progressive dispensationalists are embracing more of the true prophetic biblical declarations about responsibility toward the marginalized poor, blind, and oppressed, the strangers in the land. Genesis 12 has been the basis of much of Zionist propaganda that God would bless those who bless you, to Abraham, and above all, the people you curse, he will curse. The fact is, that promise wasn't made to Israel, it was made to Abraham, the father of all of us. They forget that. There is a changing sensitivity. Increasingly, people are understood to be chosen, as in the old children's song, "All the Children of the World, Red and Yellow, Black and White." My evangelical colleagues now say Jews, Christians, and Muslims are precious in his sight. The more liberal and progressive social justice denominations and believers, including many Jews, align themselves with the 2006 statement on Christian Zionism by the Jerusalem Patriarchs of the traditional faiths. They declared, quote, "We categorically reject Christian Zionist doctrines as false teaching that corrupts the Bible's message of love, justice, and reconciliation," end quote. And the American National Council of Churches adds, "The theological stance of Christian Zionism adversely affects justice and peace in the Middle East." Unusually, on February 22nd, just passed, in response to U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, 25 well-known senior evangelical leaders expressed concern, albeit too timidly, in my view, about unprecedented actions that may jeopardize lives and future, security of the people of the Holy Land. I hope they can be more concerned about current Palestinian suffering, but it opens the door for more White House dialogue. Therefore, it is questionable how much contemporary American theology and electoral politicking and legislating are being driven extensively by heretical dispensational understanding of Eretz Israel. Further evidence of it being challenged is because of actions by evangelical organizations such as Sojourners, Evangelicals for Social Action, faith-based operational agencies who have some of their staff people in prison. These and other faith groups are partnering with J Street, Jewish Voice for Peace, New Israel Fund, operational agencies, as well as the think tanks such as Middle East Institute and the Foundation for Peace. Also great films, God on Our Side, Road to Apartheid, Occupation of the American Mind, Nora's film, Gaza, Gaping Wound, Gaza in Context, etc. Social justice evangelicals are working to rehabilitate their brand, or frankly, to desert it if necessary, in order to differentiate further from the Haggis, Pences, and Moores of the world, which has potential for impacting the fall elections. Members of Congress who have expressed quiet opposition for Israeli policies are being more vocal regarding treatment of children, Betty McCollum's bill on child prisoners, MCs Price and Welch's, and 100 members' action on UNRWA, which is a questionable pursuit. And in conclusion, many prominent progressive leaders are helping to sharpen our thinking regarding Christian Zionists, for the God they portray looks to be militaristic, xenophobic, genocidist, and would not sufficiently be moral enough to conform to the Fourth Geneva Convention. So as God turned from love and grace to be a great ethnic cleanser, Martin Buber, the great ethicist, said in his declaration of opposition to Zionism, "Hatred is bound to ruin us. Guilt and complicity are twins hard to separate. Those who pull the trigger and those who pay for the guns are inextricably bound." Anglican theologian Naeem Attiq states, "We must oppose Christian Zionism by asserting one clear principle. Any religion that does not promote justice, truth, peace, love, forgiveness, and reconciliation among people has lost its rudder and is undeserving of respect. Their religion and their teachings are destructive rather than liberating force in the world. I would place Christian Zionists in this group," he says, "having seen their impact personally while living in Jerusalem and in other places in the world, I do too. Thanks very much."
Thank you very much. So we have about 3 minutes for questions, so I'll shoot about maybe two of them to you, and if you could respond relatively quickly, that'd be appreciated. One person asks, "Can you say something about Israel's treatment of Palestinian Christians and Western Christian NGOs such as World Vision, where you previously worked?" And another person asked, "What does it say about Christians United for Israel, the largest Christian Zionist lobby, that their executive director is Ehud Barak's cousin and is not actually a Christian?"
Well, that says a lot. I don't need to answer that. It shows, dare use the word evil, of the kind of collaboration that happens around a political issue rather than moral and ethical issues. On the first question, I believe the NGOs are being stifled. They're being shut up. They're being arrested as a cooling effort to scare our people. I think the NGOs generally are in the target big time, and some of our staff people are arrested for trumped-up charges that are just so counterintuitive as to be ridiculous. And talking to the lawyers about what happens to these people, an Israeli Jew, says we all together must speak out more about this atrocity, because these folks are innocent as the day is long, but the Israeli government finds them an easy target, and it can be used to stifle advocacy. And when marketing plays such an important role for operational agencies, or for churches for that matter, this has a huge impact. Enough said. Thanks.
You have been listening to Thomas Getman speaking before the conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. Before we sign off this morning, I would like to add a recording of a short interview with independent journalist Max Blumenthal. It has to do with Interpol recognizing Palestine by allowing it to become a member, giving it a kind of state recognition. Of course, Israel fights back whenever there is such a recognition of Palestine, as it did when UNESCO also recognized them. Here is that interview with Max Blumenthal.
Israel is threatening retaliation after Interpol voted to accept Palestine as a state member. The Israeli Prime Minister even accused the Palestinian leadership of hindering any chance of peace in the troubled region. In fact, Interpol joins a long list of international organizations to recognize Palestine's statehood. The territory declared independence in late 1998 and was recognized by dozens of countries, including every Arab state, the Soviet Union, and its allies. More states recognized the country over the next few decades. Now, a breakthrough for Palestine came in 2011 when it was accepted to UNESCO. And a year after that, UN General Assemblies, they upgraded Palestine's status from non-state entity to non-member state. So to talk more about all of this, we're being joined now by investigative journalist and author Max Blumenthal. Hey, Max, good to see you on Friday.
Good to see
you. So real quick, first let's take a listen to Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu, to his reaction on Interpol's move.
This attempt is part of an ongoing Palestinian campaign to continue the conflict with Israel inside professional international bodies in a way that disrupts these bodies' work. The Palestinian diplomatic warfare will not go unanswered.
All right, Max, you just saw that. What are your thoughts?
Well,
you're laughing, I see.
Yeah, I'm kind of laughing because, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu gets upset any time a Palestinian sneezes or coughs or has, turns in his bed at night. So it's consistent with general opposition, not only to any Palestinian diplomatic moves, but to the very existence of the state of Palestine. That's one reason why Israel is upset, that Interpol is one other agency that confers upon the Palestinian Authority the legitimacy of statehood. The other reason, which I think is more interesting and more revealing, is that there are red notifications that countries who participate in Interpol can put out, and that allows them to track, oppressive states will track dissidents, but they'll also track international criminals. The Palestinian Authority could use a red notification to put out an alert for an Israeli war criminal like Tzipi Livni, who is implicated in war crimes in the Gaza Strip when she was foreign minister between 2008 and 2009. And actually, when she landed in London fairly recently, she had to leave because she was told to report to the British police because of universal jurisdiction. So this is really what Israel's worried about. And it's basically a tacit admission that they know that they have some blood on their hands and that they don't want to be held accountable.
Sort of their free pass has been taken away by this.
They fear that, certainly. Of course, the U.S. is there to protect them and also opposes Palestinian participation in Interpol.
Speaking of U.S., the ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, apparently just recently break with the longstanding U.S. Consensus on a two-state solution.
Yeah.
And he did this in a recent interview with Israel's Walla News. Friedman said, quote, "I believe settlements are a part of Israel," and cited UN Resolution 242. Does 242 really back up Friedman's contention that that really, he says that they're occupying 2% of the West Bank? Is there really evidence to support that?
Yeah, obviously not. I mean, this is something you hear from the settlement movement in Israel, and you hear it from the governing Likud party of Benjamin Netanyahu. It's absurd. And what he's referring to is just parts of area, 2% of the population that is Jewish who lives in Area C, because it's divided under the Oslo Accords into A, B, and C. Area A are the main Palestinian population centers, but those centers are occupied. Qalqilya, for example, the city of Qalqilya is in Area A, and it's one of those areas that David Friedman thinks isn't occupied. The problem is the city of Qalqilya is completely surrounded by the Israeli separation wall on all sides, and so it's losing its population, because imagine living in a walled-in city. It's like something Montgomery Burns would have created in a Simpsons dystopia. So that's the reality. But the most interesting thing to me about Friedman is this is a guy who has business ties to the settlement enterprise. He's a Trump appointee. He really represents the hardline right-wing pro-settlement ideology. And he is basically saying that there's no such thing as a Palestinian state, which explodes the whole peace process. It explodes the concept of a two-state solution.
Right.
And so you not only have, you know, the Palestinian Authority getting upset, the state, U.S. State Department is upset at its own appointee in Jerusalem.
But Heather Nauert, the former reporter turned State Department spokesperson, she says that his comments don't actually reflect the administration's beliefs. What do you make of that?
Well, the strategy since 1967 for the kind of mainstream pro-Israel elements in Washington and Washington itself has been to never set timetables on negotiations and to basically say we're working towards a two-state solution and a Palestinian state while allowing Israel to continue building settlements. Since then, they've moved something like 500 to 600,000 settlers into the West Bank. What Friedman has done is essentially saying there's no two-state solution. Those Palestinians that are in the West Bank are now under the control of Israel, and they have no rights to vote, no civil rights, no human rights, and he's essentially officializing apartheid, which is itself a crime at the UN.
Is what Friedman saying sort of like a Freudian slip? Is that really what the administration thinks then?
Well, this is what the right wing of the administration wants to do, which is a one-state solution, but if you live in Israel-Palestine, you're in a one-state reality. So I think, and a lot of people who have strategized about this think that it's time to recognize that one-state reality and move towards a binational state with equal rights. And the way forward is to recognize that Israel has enacted a system of apartheid, and that means eliminating this concept of Palestinian statehood, which is a total fantasy, and recognizing the reality on the ground where you have close to 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank alone in East Jerusalem who have no rights.
All right. As always, Max, thanks for sharing your expertise on the subject. Investigative journalist and author Max Blumenthal.
Thanks for having me.
That was an interview with independent journalist Max Blumenthal following the recognition of Palestine by Interpol. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.